All right, so today's cheer is sponsored by Renee Rosenberg, commemorating the upcoming yard site of Selwyn Friedlander, Shmuel ben Eliyahu, zichrona libracha. Thank you so much for sponsoring. Really appreciate it. And we're going to be discussing catfight or cooperation, female relationships in the Tanakh. And to begin, there's actually a book that came out recently, which is called BFF, A Memoir of Friendship Lost and Found, written by an author named Christy Tate, who also wrote a different book, called Group. So it was about group therapy and her experiences in group therapy. And I thought that this book, which is somewhat of a memoir, was very interesting because it explored female friendships and female relationships. And so I have a couple of excerpts that are going to help us frame today's discussion. So here we go. Excerpt number one. It's just that my throat constricted and words evaporated. Honestly, what was the big deal? Amma was pregnant and it generated more excitement than my engagement? Of course it did. She carried new life in her body. I'd gotten a new piece of jewelry. What was my problem? All through my friendships with Kylie, Amma, and Claire, I've been sad and ashamed of being a hot mess in my romantic relationships. The sad girl running off to a recovery meeting or group therapy. My big problem was my terrible taste in men, my romantic stuff, my struggles with addiction. All these years, they had boyfriends and then husbands, while I waved my hands in front of my face. Whatever it was that I had. Broken, failed, flawed relationships. Tonight was supposed to be a triumph, a leveling, a chance to stand right next to them without my throat closed up again. I don't know what's happening, I whispered. I don't think he could hear my muffled words. I wasn't ready to say them clearly to another person. I thought having a partner would fix my apartness from my friends. I thought the shame attacks would be gone for good once I got engaged. I thought the big work of my life was learning to find a healthy partner. I thought the hard work was over. So I think this is a relatable feeling. I think it's not just Christy who has had this experience where there is a belief that there's a timeline in your life and, you know, this one is married and I should be married, or this one found a partner and I should find a partner, and oh, if I've achieved that, then I've achieved something, right? And Christy says, I thought it was going to fix me. I thought it was going to be completely fixed. And you know what? It didn't quite work that way. And then she continues in excerpt number two. It's a girl, I blurted out to Meredith when we met for breakfast shortly after my 20-week ultrasound. Amazing! Her eyes filled with tears and she grabbed my hand. You're going to have so much fun. I cocked my head at her and squinted my eyes. You're the first person to say that. That it'll be fun? Yes. In the weeks I'd found out that I was having a girl, I'd mentioned it in almost every conversation. In turn, I discovered that people had strong feelings about baby girls, even before the babies were born. I recounted some for Meredith. A girl? Congratulations and buckle up. So much drama. Are you worried she'll have an eating disorder like you? Girls are so expensive. I'm so glad I had boys, less work, and way less drama. A girl is good because she'll take care of you when you get older, but she'll make you earn it during her childhood. Good luck with the teenage years. Wow, you'll be going through menopause when she gets her first period. What the hell is wrong with people? I asked Meredith. So much is wrong with people. As if it's not dramatic to get into fights and beat the blank out of other boys on the football field or hockey rink or to knock around a girlfriend. No drama there. Now that I was carrying a baby girl and listening to strangers, colleagues, friends, and family members project their fantasies of difficulty and drama onto her tiny fetal head, I felt compassion for all of us. Before we take our first breath, we are written into a script about our difficult personalities, our emotional volatility, our fraught relationships, our propensity for so-called drama. So, I think, once again, this is probably not unique to Christy, that people have different responses when they hear someone's having a boy versus a girl. And there are all these beliefs about girls and about what they're going to be like and whether they're going to be difficult. And we have this vision of girls that it makes you wonder, like, is that actually true, or are we projecting it onto the girls in our lives? So there's something called the Bechdel test. And here's how it works. This is source 3. A rule which aims to determine a film's feminist credentials. According to the Bechdel test, a film may be regarded as feminist if it satisfies 3 basic requirements. 1, the film has at least 2 female characters. 2, these 2 female characters within the film talk to each other. And 3, what the 2 female characters in the film talk about has nothing to do with a man. So you would be surprised how many films actually fail this test, because if there are girls in them, the only thing the girls exist to do, or the women exist to do, is to fight about the relationship with some guy that they both are after. So you can take a moment and start to consider, you know, different films you've seen and whether they fail or not. So given this background, where society at large, at least in Christie's experience, has certain beliefs about what a girl is like and what raising a girl will be like and has these projections and so on, I thought it would be interesting to look at the Tanakh, which is Torah, Nevi'im, and Ketuvim, and to look at female relationships within the Tanakh. Now, the interesting thing is, we don't actually see that many friendships in general within the Tanakh, because the Tanakh exists on a variety of different levels. Part of it is it's providing some historical information. Part of it is providing laws and mitzvot. Part of it is providing information to guide us in terms of our life. And usually, if it's not directly relevant to the storyline, it's not going to be in there. So there are some famous relationships that we can think of, whether it's a boy or a girl, probably Yonatan and David come to mind. And there are some when it comes to women as well, but not that many. So what I figured I would do is I would look at the ones that exist, and we would analyze what's going on in terms of this female relationship. Are they getting along? Are they not getting along? Is it closer to the idea of the cat fight, or is it closer to the idea of actual cooperation between women? And what can we learn as we examine each of these scenarios? So we're going to start with the one that's closer to cat fight. And this has to do with Sarah and Hagar. So here we go. Sarah and Hagar. I'm going to go with the English. You can feel free to also look at the Hebrew. I'm in source 4. Sarai, Avram's wife, had borne him no children. She had an Egyptian maidservant whose name was Hagar. And Sarai said to Avram, "Look, God has kept me from bearing. Consort with my maid. Perhaps I shall have a child through her." And Avram listened to Sarai's request. So Sarai, Avram's wife, took her maid Hagar the Egyptian. After Avram had dwelt in the land of Canaan 10 years, gave her to her husband Avram as a concubine. He cohabited with her, and she conceived. And when she saw that she had conceived, her mistress was lowered in her esteem. And Sarai said to Avram, "The wrong done me is your fault. I myself gave you the maid. Now that she sees that she's pregnant, I'm lowered in her eyes. God decide between you and me." Avram said to Sarai, "Your maid is in your hands. Deal with her as you think right." Then Sarai treated her harshly, and she ran away from her. So this is a story where there's a lot of pain in this story, right? Sarai desperately wants to have a child. She's not able to have one. And she figures, just because I can't have one, I don't want my beloved husband to never have children. So we'll make this situation work. I'll give him Hagar, and I will consider it as if Hagar's child is my child, which is what the Radak says in Source 5, right? She looked at it as this child is going to be her child. Let's figure out where this continues. It doesn't look like... Oh, yeah, you're saying Hagar looks at it as being her own child. Yes, yes. Okay, so Radak had this view that Sarai wanted her to be accepted as if she were part of the biological family. And then if you look at Source 6, what you see in Rashi is Rashi says that in her jealousy, Sarai looked at Hagar's swollen belly with an evil eye, something which would have resulted in Hagar losing her fetus, which is why the angel told her that she was pregnant, a fact that Hagar had been well aware of, but the idea was that Hagar would give birth to a son. She doesn't have to fear to abort her fetus on account of Sarai giving her the evil eye. So we have Sarai as a very human person in this depiction, which is not always the way that our matriarchs and patriarchs are taught to us. Sometimes we're taught about how they were on this very high level, they were on a pedestal. That's one way to teach. But there's also a way to look at them as they accomplished amazing things and they're worth looking up to for sure, obviously. But they also had challenges and they responded to those challenges in a more human way. So if you look at Radak again, Source 7, this is what you learn. Sarai afflicted her. She did with her Hagar excessively. She worked her with backbreaking labor. It's possible that Sarai hit her and cursed her, and Hagar wasn't able to bear it, so she ran away from her. And Sarai was not behaving this way out of the trait of ethical behavior or the trait of piety. Her behavior was considered not good, right? And Avram did not stop Sarai from afflicting her, even though it was evil in his eyes due to shalom bias. And this story was written in the Torah to show that an individual should strive to acquire good attributes and should distance himself from bad ones. So the Radak is really giving a condemnation of Sarai's behavior in this scene. Even though it was very human behavior, and even though we understand it, still he's saying this was not ideal. This was not a good thing. And in fact, to take that even further, in Source 8, Rabbi Menachem Kasher wrote a Haggadah. Some of you may have this Haggadah, where he says, Rabbi Shimon, the son of Yochai, said, Hagar was the daughter of Paro. When Paro saw what was done on Sarah's behalf in his own house, he took his daughter and gave her to Sarah. He called her Hagar, which name is a form of the Aramaic phrase, Havagrah, here is your reward. Later, Holy Writ informs us, Sarah tormented her. Because of her harshness to Hagar, Sarah's descendants were afflicted and enslaved by the Egyptians. So that's super harsh, because that's saying that she is actually considered one of the causes for the later on pain that the entire nation undergoes, because she was cruel to Hagar in that moment. So this is an example of two women who are not getting along. At the root of it is the issue of the man that they share, right? So this wouldn't really pass the Bechdel test. And also about progeny and who's going to give birth to this child who will survive and inherit and so on. So here we have an example of women who are not in what we would call a happy filial, you know, spirit of friendship. That's not what's happening here. So then we move to a little bit of a more complicated example, Rachel and Leah, who are sisters. So here we have source 9. Laban had two daughters. The name of the older one was Leah. The name of the younger one was Rachel. Leah had weak eyes. Rachel was shapely and beautiful. Yaakov loved Rachel. So he answered, I will serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban said, better that I give her to you than that I should give her to an outsider. Stay with me. So Yaakov served 7 years for Rachel. They seemed to him but a few days because of his love for her. Then eventually he asks for his wife. And what happens is Laban makes a feast. And that evening he brings Leah. And that's who Yaakov ends up marrying. He ends up marrying Leah. When the morning came, there was Leah. So he, meaning Yaakov, said to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me? Laban said, it's not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older. Okay, and then we continue the story in source 10. Yaakov cohabited with Rachel also. He loved Rachel more than Leah. He served him another 7 years. So we have this situation that is marred by tragedy. Because from the very beginning, he wanted Rachel, that's who he had served for, but he ended up with Leah. Now here's something really important. If you go back to source 9, we have learned this story a million times, and often we have learned this story with the Midrashic rendering. But for right now, I want you to put aside whatever previous knowledge you may have of what's going on in this story with Rachel and Leah, and just focus on a close reading of the text. And here's what I want you to notice. When Yaakov has this conversation with Laban about the daughter that he wants, it does not seem like anyone else is present for the conversation. The conversation is taking place between two men, right? Laban and Yaakov. And Yaakov tells him, I'll serve you 7 years for your younger daughter, Rachel. Laban says, better that I give her to you, and so on. And in the morning, when Yaakov wakes up and he sees it's Leah, he doesn't say to Leah, why are you here? He doesn't accuse her, he doesn't talk to her, nothing. He again goes and he speaks to her dad. And when he talks to her dad, he says, right, he says to Laban, what is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. So what's important here is the question of, what did Rachel and Leah know about this arrangement? Did they know there was an arrangement? Did they know that he was serving for Rachel? When Leah got married to Yaakov, was she aware that there was an agreement that she was breaking when she got married to him or not? So depending on how you read the story, the tragedy amplifies. Because you could either read the story that all along, all the parties were aware that Rachel was supposed to marry Yaakov, and according to the Midrash, Leah was originally destined to marry Esav, and there was this whole situation of how she didn't want to, she was crying, that's a Midrashic rendering. But here's an alternative rendering. This was an agreement that was made between the two men, so the men knew who was destined for who. Here's Leah, who's being informed, guess what? It's your wedding day! Go get dressed, go get married, you're gonna go marry Yaakov! How awesome! So she goes happily, excitedly, marries Yaakov, and she is totally unaware that she has stepped into the middle of this whole debacle in terms of Rachel being promised. Now, the way we learn it in elementary school, we learn about the tokens, the signs that were given from Rachel to Leah so that she wouldn't be embarrassed. So the obvious question is, well, if you believe that Rachel did this big act of chesed and she gave the tokens to her sister, then wouldn't that mean that Leah was aware that she wasn't the destined bride? So we're going to look at a couple of interpretations of how that fits in the next couple of sources. We're going to start with, let's see, if you look at source 11, Right, when Rachel saw that she had borne Yaakov no children, she became envious of her sister. And Rachel said to Yaakov, give me children or I shall die. So we have jealousy here. And then we have this really interesting, important scene in source 12. Once at the time of the wheat harvest, Reuben came upon some mandrakes in the field, brought them to his mother Leah. Rachel said to Leah, please give me some of your son's mandrakes, Dudaim. But she said to her, was it not enough for you to take away my husband that you would also take my son's mandrakes? Now there's a problem with the question. If we go according to the approach, which is the way that we usually learn it, that Leah was given the symbols by Rachel in order to trick Yaakov into believing that it was really Rachel, then she knows that it was never really her husband to have taken away. All along, that man was destined for Rachel. But again, if you look at the Pshat reading, it's, was it not enough for you to take away my husband that you would also take my son's mandrakes? Leah's very bitter, because Leah feels like, I got married, this was supposed to be my marriage, and then you, as the interloper, got married to him afterwards, and you've stolen all his affection. So we're going to look at some of the ways that they deal with this question, because every commentator has to understand why is Leah phrasing this question this way, even if you go with the token understanding. Okay, so in source 13, we have the story that we learn in school, right? So it says that the modesty displayed by Rachel, Yaakov told Rachel he was her father's brother. Okay, we're going to skip down. He gave her certain tokens. When night came, she said to herself, now my sister will be put to shame. So she handed over the tokens to her. It is written, it came to pass in the morning that behold, it was Leah. Up to now, she was not Leah. Rather, what it means is that on account of the tokens which Rachel gave to Leah, he did not know until then. So that's the source, this Gemara. But now we're going to look at source 14. So Mr. Chaim Kohanchi, who was actually a member of this community, wrote a series of svarim called the Ner Chaim, and he brings down this approach that's fascinating. So this is what he says. It's a part in bold. Rabbi Shalom Shwadron says that this is what happened. Rachel did not have the heart to tell her sister that she was rejected by Yaakov and that she would be sneaked under the chuppah as merely another one of their father's swindles. So in order to save Leah's dignity, she came up with a plan. She told Leah that she wants her to know about certain things that Yaakov holds dear, things that he likes to hear about all the time, certain signs about the mitzvot that are really important to him. Knowing them would promote shalom bayit between the new couple. She told Leah, it's important for you to know the three crucial mitzvot of a Jewish woman. Challah, nida, which is the laws of family purity, v'hadlakas neros, lighting the candles. So, Leah went under the chuppah with a husband who she thought had worked 7 years for her hand. That night, when Yaakov asked her, what are the three important things a wife needs to know? Leah knew the answer and innocently gave it in order to show her new husband how she was adopting his values. She never knew that these were the signs Yaakov had set up to prevent a swindle. So according to this approach, you can actually homogenize. You can make them both work. Here, Rachel is doing this action of great self-sacrifice, where she is permitting her sister to marry the man that she is supposed to be marrying, the person that she loves, the person who loves her. But she's doing it in such a manner that her sister actually doesn't know that that's what's happened. And it's coming from a place of love. Now, the problem is that this gets very messy. Because later on, Leah's understanding, according to the Pshat reading, is that Rachel is the one who stole her husband and who stole her husband's affection. And she's unaware of the fact that Rachel all along was the intended bride. So this brings us to some of the tragedy and like the outcomes that come from the fact that one of them is attempting to protect the other rather than having like the clear lines of communication be open. So if you look at source 15, we have an excerpt from Tribal Blueprints, 12 Brothers in the Destiny of Israel by Nechama Price, Token of Love. Right, this story could be a pure and innocent depiction of a sensitive young boy who recognizes his mother's sadness and tries to cheer her up with a bouquet of flowers. These flowers are a token of his love to make up for the lack of love and gestures of affection that she should receive from her husband. Moreover, Reuven may be aware of his parents' strained relationship, either because Leah talks to her elder son about her predicament, or just because it's something he observes in their home. He watches Yaakov's treatment of her during the day and sees her crying at night. As her older son, Reuven may be the shoulder that Leah cries on, so too, he may know the significance behind his own name, his mother's desperate plea for love, and he wants to help her fill that void. According to this line of thinking, Rachel trades a night with Yaakov for these flowers because they embody a child's love for his mother. She's desperate to feel the tangible love of a child. Rachel's anguish is passionately expressed only a few verses earlier when she lashes out at Yaakov saying, give me children or else I will die. Clearly to Rachel, these flowers embody what she covets most in the world, the love of a child for his mother. So, if the mandrakes are a token of love, Even as a youngster, Reuven recognizes his mother's sadness, gives her the flowers as a token of his love. Perhaps as she is occupied with trying to have more children and gaining her husband's love, she is not giving proper attention to her eldest son. Reuven feels left out and craves his mother's attention, hoping that she might find satisfaction in the love of her children. How tragically disappointing it must have been for him to come home and discover his flowers in his aunt's tent. His mother discarded this token of his love for her just to spend more time with his father. So, here we have a situation that on the one hand was intended for the good, right? It's an act of chesed, it's an act of love, and it's often looked at in a very positive light, meaning later on when we learn Yirmiyahu, there's actually a midrash that says that when God is angry with Bnei Israel because they're worshipping Avodah Zarah, they're worshipping idols, Rachel is able to come and say, look, I welcomed my rival into my own house. Look at this act of self-sacrifice that I did. How can you remain angry with Bnei Israel for worshipping idols, which is a huge temptation to them? And then, even though God was unwilling, according to the midrash, to listen to anyone else's defense, he didn't listen to Avraham or to Yitzchak or to Yaakov, he does listen to Rachel, because what she has to say is very compelling. But the problem is that, according to this rendering, even though everything came from this good place of actually caring about her sister and love for her sister and so on, the fact that Leah was never looped into what actually had happened led to so much heartbreak and so much misery. It wouldn't have been happy-making for Leah to know that actually all along you were never the one who was intended and that you weren't the one who Yaakov loved, but perhaps having that clarity and having all that information out on the table could have led to an outcome where she wasn't looking at it as, you know, my sister came in and stole my husband, and you know, bartering, you know, with in a way that impacted potentially her child, impacted Reuven later on. So this seems to be a story where you could argue we're edging maybe a little bit closer to cooperation in that they're trying, or at least Rachel is trying, but unfortunately it has unintended side effects and consequences, which seem to suggest that actually if they had been totally forthright and clear, even if it would have been hurtful, it might have been better. So that brings us to Chana and Peninnah, who happen in the book of Shmuel. So, right, one such day, Elkanah offered a sacrifice. He used to give portions to his wife Peninnah and to all her sons and daughters, but to Chana he would give one choice portion. Chana was his favorite. Her rival, to make her miserable, would taunt her that the Lord had closed her womb. This happened year after year. Every time she went up to the house of the Lord, the other would taunt her, so she would weep and not eat. Her husband Elkanah said to her, Chana, why are you crying and why aren't you eating? Why are you so sad? Am I not more devoted to you than 10 sons? So, on a straightforward reading, a pshat reading, Peninnah just comes across as a horrible person, right? Here you have this woman who's already suffering, can't have a child, and here you are taunting her, making her life miserable, making her cry, not having any compassion for her. So, source 17 just compiles several different midrashic readings, right? There was tension between Peninnah and Chana caused by the latter's infertility. There were several different midrashic midrashic traditions. Right, so Peninnah would tell Chana, did you buy a sweater for your eldest son? Did you buy a shirt for your second son? Or rise early in the morning? Aren't you getting up to wash your children's faces before they go to school? 6 hours later, aren't you going to greet your children when they come home from school? And Peninnah would grieve Chana by means of ordinary everyday activities, taking pains to remind her at all hours of the day the difference between them. Or when they were eating in Shiloh, Peninnah would say to her husband, give to this son of mine his portion, to this son of mine you did not give his portion, all in order to anger Chana, who has to watch all of this. Now, what's interesting is the midrashic understanding is that Chana was the first wife. So because Chana was the first wife, what happened was she was married for a number of years, she was infertile, she didn't have kids, and at some point, Elkanah marries his second wife, which is Peninnah. So even though Peninnah is being mean-spirited and cruel, it's possible that that's actually coming from a place of knowing all along, I wasn't the chosen wife. You know, I was the second best. I came along because Chana couldn't have kids. So unfortunately, once again, you have this scenario where both of these women are unhappy in different ways, and rather than working together, they don't. You know, Peninnah's at Chana's throat. Now, there is one positive interpretation of Peninnah, which I brought down in the Rashi in source 18, where she does everything she does in order that Chana should complain. Our rabbis explain, in order to make her storm, that she pray, Peninnah had good intentions. And according to this approach, which is usually the approach that is taught in school, Peninnah did everything l'shem shemayim. She really wanted Chana to daven, she wanted her to pray, and she was hoping that if Chana prayed, then she would get a child. So that is one positive approach, but it's not the only approach. There's other approaches that say that she was simply cruel. So far we've had three examples of female relationships where women are feeling threatened by one another, threatened by the fact that their husband has a closer relationship to one than the other, threatened by the fact that one has children and one doesn't. And because they're coming from this place of threat or insecurity, they don't treat each other well, right? At minimum, they don't cooperate with each other. At maximum, they're actually cruel to each other. So now we're going to shift, and we're going to look at some scenarios that focus on cooperation between women in the Tanakh. And the first one is Rivka and Devorah. Now you might be wondering, who is Devorah? Devorah is actually not the Devorah that you're probably thinking of, who comes up later in the book of Judges. Not talking about her. We're talking about someone else that most people don't even learn about, because she shows up very briefly. But here she is, in source 19. Right? Ve'eshalchu et Rivka achotam v'yat menikta v'yat eved Avraham v'yat anashav. They send off their sister Rebecca and her nurse, along with Avraham's servant and his entourage. And then you look at Breishit. Vatamat Devorah meneket Rivka. Devorah, Rebecca's nurse, died. Vatikaver mitachat lebeit el, tachat ha'ilon, vayikra shemo elon bachut. Was buried under the oak below Beit El. It was named Alon Bachut, the Plain of Tears. Now, the names of places are significant in the Tanakh, and if you're naming this place where this woman is buried the Plain of Tears, then what that signifies is there was a lot of mourning associated with the death of this woman. So, who was this woman? Who was this nurse? Why does she matter, and why are we mourning so much for her? So Targum Yonatan translates, Umita Devorah Pidgugta Derivka. So Devorah, the pedagogue of Rivka, died. So in that understanding, it's not a nurse in the traditional sense of a babysitter. We're talking about someone who was basically Rivka's governess, her pedagogue, her teacher, her instructor. That is the woman who accompanied Rivka when she was sent off. That's the woman who died, and that's the woman who we're crying so much about that we call the place where she ends up buried Elon Bachut, the Plain of Tears. So why? You know, what was it about their relationship that was so important that there was so much, you know, there were tears associated with it? So here we have on source 22, there's an excerpt from a Chabad.org article, Who Was Devorah the Nurse? Why Did Yaakov Mourn Her Death? Right, so Yonatan says, as we saw, she was an expert teacher. Targum Yonatan renders the word we translated as nurse to be pedagogue, a teacher. This was Rebecca's teacher. When Rebecca was a young girl living in an immoral society with her deceitful father and brother, she had a support system. Devorah helped her stand strong and pious in the face of immorality and deprivation. This is a lesson on gratitude, a lesson on the power of a good teacher, and a lesson on how impacting one person, Rivka, matriarch of the Jewish people, can transform history forever. So, this is really important because of Rivka's background. If you remember Rivka, Rivka's the daughter of someone called Betuel, and she's the sister of someone called Lavan. And neither of those people are good people. Even in Pshat, they're not good people. And definitely in the Midrashic renderings, Betuel is considered to be a man who used to go and have sex with all the virgins before they could go get married. He primo noctis was like his thing that he practiced, which is a pretty bad thing. And then Lavan, we see him as someone who's greedy, who wants money. We see that he swindles Yaakov, he tricks him. So if that's the society in which Rivka was growing up, typically people are a combination of nature and nurture. And so someone might have genetically a predisposition to being a good moral person, but if you grow up and everyone around you behaves a certain way, it's more likely than not that you would end up behaving the way that you've been brought up, and you're in some ways a product of your environment. So the question that arises is, how come Rivka wasn't a product of her environment? Was it just her alone who had some kind of amazing strength? And the answer that's given here is no. She did have a role model. She had this governess, she had this nurse, this pedagogue, Devorah, and that was the person who was so important that when she went off on this journey to marry this unknown man, Yitzchak, that's the person who accompanied her, and that's the person who stayed with her, and that's the person whose loss was mourned. Now, the thing that's important is that not always does the governess or the teacher of the household have someone's best interests in mind. So an example of that, for those of you who have read Wuthering Heights by Charlotte Bronte, there's this woman in the book called Nellie. And Nellie is like the nurse governess figure for Catherine. And there's this really important scene where this guy called Heathcliff is speaking and he's confessing something. And Catherine is speaking and Heathcliff is overhearing it. And Heathcliff overhears a part of it, and then he leaves. And the problem is that what Catherine is in the middle of saying is how she could never marry Heathcliff, but then she continues on with this very significant part that Heathcliff doesn't hear about how she loves him like her own soul, and so on and so forth. And there's a lot of different scenes where Nelly has the potential to intervene for the good and to actually make things go well between the two of them, and she doesn't. And she meddles, and she causes all sorts of problems because she's obsessed with her self-importance, which is a different topic altogether. But the point I'm trying to make is you cannot assume that just because someone is hired to be a governess or to be a nurse, that they'll be a good one, that they'll like the person that they're working with, that they'll have their child's best interests in mind. And so the fact that Devorah did, and that Devorah was willing and focused on bringing Rivka up in a manner that was different from what she was seeing modeled, was super impressive, because Rivka ends up becoming one of our foremothers, and who knows if Rivka could have turned out that way without Devorah. So here we have an example of women, you know, getting along, cooperation, positive relationships, and there's no men involved, right? Nobody's fighting over a man, which is a nice perk. Okay, Shifra and Pua. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra, the other Pua, saying, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, look at the birth stool. If it's a boy, kill him. If it's a girl, let her live." And of course, they don't do this, and then they're summoned back to figure out why are they not doing this, and they say, look, the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. Before the midwife can come to them, they've given birth. So there's several different interpretations of who exactly are these women, Shifra and Pua. So we've got Rashi. Right, Shifra, this was Yocheved. She bore this additional name because she used to put the baby after its birth into good physical condition by the care she bestowed. Pua, this was Miriam. She bore this additional name because she used to call aloud and speak and croon to the baby, just as women do who soothe a child. That's what we typically get taught in Jewish day school, that these women are Yocheved and Miriam. But that's not the only rendering of who Shifra and Pua were. So if you look at source 25, right, who were Shifra and Pua, the Hebrew midwives? Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid believed that Shifra and Pua were actually righteous converts, as it wouldn't make sense that Paro would ask two Jewish women to kill members of their own faith and family. So that's another possibility. And then the Malbim says that Shifra and Pua are not names of people, but rather job titles. One job entails helping a mother through the labor process, the other cutting the umbilical cord and tending to the new baby's needs. For the record, even in the hospital nowadays, you have that. You have the person who's assisting with labor and delivery, and then you have the person who's working with postpartum care. So according to this, right, Shifra was labor and delivery, and Pua was postpartum care, and that's what you had. Now here's the thing that we fail to think about, but it's actually so important to think about. Those two women had to align. They had to agree. Both of us will thwart Pharaoh's commands. Because if either one of them decided, I'm frightened of Paro, I'm planning to do this, then she could have informed on the other one. So the only way that this ability to keep the boys alive would work is if those women together as a team decided, we are cooperating in this endeavor to not do what Pharaoh wants. And if you say it's Yocheved and Miriam, then it's a little less impressive. Because yeah, it's a mom and daughter team, they also have biological bonds between the two of them, fine. But if you say that they're not connected by blood, it's either two converts or it's people who are simply in different roles. I'm in the labor and delivery role and you're in the postpartum role and we're Egyptian women potentially, which is another approach that they were Hebrew midwives, meaning that they were Egyptian midwives who cared for the Hebrew women. That's crazy because you need to have not just one righteous among the nations, you need to have two or more because there was also an approach that said that these people were like the leaders of the team, but the team was larger than the two of them. So that's a lot of cooperation of a lot of women deciding, you know what, we think this is morally wrong, and we are going to choose to risk our own lives to go against Pharaoh because we think this is morally wrong, and none of us will inform on the other. We're going to make a pact, we're going to keep to the pact, we're going to be a strong sisterhood of people who will oppose Pharaoh. So I think that's really cool. I love this example because the stakes are really high, and it would have been a lot easier, especially if they were Egyptian, or if they were converts who had originally been Egyptian and who had decided to convert. It would have been a lot easier to go along with what the Pharaoh was asking of them than it was to instead stand up to the Pharaoh and rely on each other, like a trust game, because that's what it is. It's a game of trust. You have to hope that no one's going to betray you in this endeavor. So after Shifra and Pua, we come to probably the strongest, you know, most vivid example of a female friendship, and that is Ruth and Naomi. So there's some very powerful words that are spoken by Ruth. Naomi is telling her, "Your sister-in-law has returned to her people and her gods. go follow your sister-in-law. But Ruth replied, do not urge me to leave you, to turn back and not follow you, for wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus and more may the Lord do to me, if anything but death parts me from you. So that's super powerful, and it's strange, meaning you have a daughter-in-law and a mother-in-law. There's obviously years between them. This isn't like a biological relationship. This isn't a blood relationship. It's not like they're committed partners in the same work area, which is what we saw before with Shifra and Pua. You at least have the similarity of we're both working to care for the women after they give birth. These are people who are related because Ruth had married this man who is now dead. So there's no reason for her. She doesn't need to feel this strong attachment to her mother-in-law, but she does. And not only does she do that, but she really shows it in many ways. So now here's what's interesting. There's a whole, the whole story of this Megillah is how they discover this redeemer, Boaz. Naomi instructs her to go out into the field and to collect the food from there. She also instructs her to go to him one night, lay down by his feet, and basically implore him to become a redeemer, become her husband, all of this. And eventually, yes, Ruth gets married to Boaz. But here's the thing. He is so not a focus after they get married that there's actually an approach that says that they were together for one night and then he dies. That's one approach. But if he's not dead, he's at least not the focus. Like, it could be that the two of them live happily together, but we're not focused on Boaz. We are very focused not only on Ruth, we are very focused on Naomi. And here's what's interesting. In Source 27, right, they're talking about the son that Ruth has just given birth to. He will renew your life and sustain your old age, for he is born of your daughter-in-law who loves you and is better to you than seven sons. Naomi took the child and held it to her bosom. She became its foster mother, and the women neighbors gave him a name, saying, a son is born to Naomi. They named him Obed. He was the father of Yishai, father of David. So what I find so interesting here is I feel like this depiction is almost showing us what could have been, right? What could have been with Sarah and Hagar, what could have been with Hannah and Peninnah, if they hadn't let all this fighting over the man get in the way of things. Because here, Ruth is giving the son over to Naomi. Naomi is raising the son as though it's her own child. And there doesn't seem to be that animosity. There's no animosity. There's no jealousy. There's no insecurity. There's no fighting for the love and affection of Boaz. He doesn't even get mentioned in the storyline. And if you say Boaz is dead, then that's a simplistic solution because, okay, he's not there to be fought over. And also, it's not like they're sister wives because one of them is the mother-in-law. But if you say Boaz is still alive, that's actually really interesting. And even the wording about how Ruth is better to you than seven sons, it echoes because we saw before that by Elkanah and Hannah, Elkanah is desperately saying to Hannah, you know, aren't I better to you than 10 sons? And the problem is Hannah really doesn't feel that way. It's not coming through. So somehow what these women have achieved, Ruth and Naomi, is they've gotten to a point where Ruth is able to almost like give over custody of the child to Naomi without all of the fraught situations that have come up in the past. And this time it's working where in the past it didn't. And obviously, I think it's important to add that the situation is different. You know, it isn't two women who are married to the same man, and I think that plays a big role in why this was an easier situation for it to end happily. But it still shows you, like, it can be done. It is possible for someone to become a surrogate mother or a foster mother, and for that to be a happy experience and a positive experience, and not one that's filled with pain and tragedy and animosity and just all kinds of really negative, bad things. So, going forward to Ruth, in source 28, this is from Ruth, From Alienation to Monarchy by Dr. Yael Ziegler. She says, I believe that we can still regard Ruth as a religious role model, even if she is motivated merely by her love for Naomi. If Ruth is willing to relinquish all possibility of a bright future, this is assuming she would have stayed in Moab, right? That's where her people were and where she had grown up. Right, because of her genuine concern and love for her elderly mother-in-law, then Ruth emerges as a woman of admirable character and profound sensitivity. From this trait of Ruth's, we learn about human love, friendship, and camaraderie. However, Ruth's commitment to Naomi may contain a theological lesson as well. In several of his essays, Rabbi Soloveitchik maintains that a person's inherent difficulty in creating a relationship with an amorphous God may be resolved by harnessing one's human relationships in order to achieve this. Judaic faith and theology are linked with finite experiences and meaningful human relations. By developing proper human relation structures, the Jew learns how to love, revere, and serve God. And then on page 22, in bold, Ruth demonstrates how one can vanquish one's own ego in pursuit of a relationship, even when it is illogical and against one's own interests to do so. And that made me reflect on the role of the ego in all the stories. And I think that that's super important, because I think that that's something that all of us are struggling with nowadays, and all the more so because we live in this fun age of social media with Instagram, where you can see everyone's lives portrayed in their photos, right? So there's so many emotions that are arising from these Tanakh texts, very human emotions that I think all of us deal with, whether it's jealousy, right? You see jealousy by Sarah and Hagar to the point that according to one of the texts that we read, Sarai is putting this evil eye on Hagar. Sarai gets punished later on for her treatment of Hagar, right? You see jealousy for sure when it comes to Leah and Rachel. You can see a situation where someone intended for good, that's what Rachel intended, but actually pure clarity and honest communication would probably have made that situation better than the subterfuge that was involved that led to everyone, or not everyone, but at least Leah feeling very confused and hurt. Because of the fact that everything was clouded and she didn't know the exact circumstances. So we've got jealousy, we've got the evil eye, the belief that things are better for other people than they are for us. Here Leah probably, you know, is desperate for love. She's having all these kids. Meanwhile, Rachel wants the kids and is kind of like, the love, you could have it. You know, she doesn't seem particularly focused about the love aspect. She just wants the kids, people wanting what other people have got, right? So much of this is so relatable, I think, to nowadays. And to the experiences that people have when you're scrolling through social media and it looks like that person has got the perfect life, or that person has got something you want, or that person had an amazing vacation and look that they have the money that they could afford the vacation. And so what's so interesting about Ruth is that Ruth is brought up as this person who sublimates her ego and who's able to look at this and say, like, what if we could get along? You know, what if we could have this situation where it's, you know, positive? Now, it's important to note that Dr. Ziegler says that Ruth is kind of like an archetype. It's not someone that we should all model, because she sublimates herself to such an extreme that if someone does that in real life, like, we would be very concerned. You know, you don't want to raise women and raise daughters who are so willing to put aside all of their own needs to only follow what their mother-in-law instructs. Dr. Ziegler's reading is that because from Ruth the monarchy would derive, this was a very necessary attribute, because monarchs, by their nature, can be all-powerful, can claim divine right, and can be so grasping and greedy that there needed to be this other extreme of extreme sublimation to, you know, balance it out. So I don't think that we should be like Ruth exactly, but I think focusing upon, where am I getting stuck in this situation? Is it my insecurity? Is it my jealousy? Is it the fact that it's not about me and I want it to be about me, which is what Christy was feeling at the very beginning when Christy had her engagement party and then someone came up with news that they were pregnant and she felt like that person had showed her up at her own special occasion. And that was, of course, not the intention of the person who was sharing that news. They were just excited, right? But that was still an emotion that Christy had to grapple with. So at the end of the book, BFF, Christy has this nice excerpt that I thought that fit well with everything we've been exploring in terms of these female relationships in the Tanakh. I visualized one of those huddles that athletes make right before a game, where each player sticks a hand into the middle of the circle, and then they chant inspiring words like, "Go, team, go!" For so many years of my life, I'd had it wrong. The hand I offered friends often became a fist I used to fight them with myself, with bystanders I perceived as threats. I no longer wanted to walk through the world with clenched hands, scanning the horizon for conflict, envy, jealousy, scarcity, women with Halle Berry cheekbones and gifted children. I wanted to offer an open palm ready to give and receive. So this is something that comes up as well in just feminist theory, the idea that part of what people become is what they're what they are told they will become, or what they see. And that's why we go back originally to the Bechdel test. Women don't need to be spending their time fighting over the guy. Women don't need to be spending all their time in jealousy or in conflict or in insecurity or in this belief about scarcity. In fact, a lot of the beliefs in Judaism directly discuss this, right? A big belief in Judaism is this belief that who's truly happy? Someone who is happy with their lot, with what they have, which means that someone else can have the mansion where they've got 12 bedrooms and they're going on their vacation to Cancun, and that might not be like my lot, but if I can find a place to, you know, being happy with mine, or if I'm not happy with mine, if I'm taking actual steps to improve mine, you know, maybe I have to go back to school for a different job, or I have to do this. And nobody's saying this is simple. Nobody's saying it's easy. But there is this belief that we will be better off, we will be happier, if we can get to the place that Christy gets to, where we're not walking through the world with conflict, envy, jealousy, scarcity, and just all these things that we want that we feel like everyone else has got. And I think that the message of the Tanakh, very interestingly, comes to that same conclusion. Because when you look at these positive relationships, like the Rivka and Devorah, or Shifra and Pua, or Ruth and Naomi, I think we can all look at those and say, those are the kinds of relationships that we want for ourselves, that we want for our daughters, that we want for our sisters. That is what we want our female friendship to look like. And wouldn't it be better if we could take steps to get us closer to there, as opposed to the other scenarios that are not as positive?